There are hip-hop musicals about founding fathers.
What's your name, man?
Alexander Hamilton. My name is Alexander Hamilton.
Hello, Hamilton. There are also musicals with singing Nazis, sort of.
Springtime for Hitler and Germany.
That one's from the producers. Well, today we're featuring musicals about the Bay Area. It's no secret that San Francisco has the most expensive rents in the country. Now, even those with high-paying tech jobs are starting to look for cheaper places to live. But rent, jobs, salaries, these are adult problems. It's not the kind of thing you'd hear kindergartners singing about. So some parents were surprised to find out that's just what their children were working on. John Mualim brings us this story from our friends at This American Life.
This past spring, we went to see the end-of-the-year musical for my daughter's after-school program at a public school in San Francisco. It was an original work, and she had a tiny part, her first play. I don't know what I expected, but it wasn't this. Act 1, Scene 1 opened on a sinister tech executive meeting with a corrupt mayor and San Francisco's Board of Supervisors. He's pitching them a new branding campaign for the city. It's meant to distract citizens from San Francisco's widening socioeconomic inequality and simmering strife. My daughter was finishing kindergarten. She was 6. One elected official, played by a 5th grader, explains that everyone knows the city is struggling. A wave of tech money is driving up real estate prices and pushing people out. She describes it as a kind of civic identity crisis.
A town that was once known as a bastion of freedom, inclusion, individuality is now known as a sterile playground for the rich.
People are frustrated. They don't want to live in a sterile playground for the rich. That's why the city's called in this branding guy, a tech marketing guru named Ron Scraper, a master of his craft who could sell water to an ocean, one kid says. Scraper can't fix the city's gentrification problem, but he has cooked up a creative way to reframe it. Sure, he says, pitching his idea to the city government, no one can afford San Francisco's rental market anymore or the $100 Uber rides. But, and here's his new slogan.
San Francisco, where you can afford to dream.
The question is, can we afford this ad campaign? What's the damage?
Oh, I'm sure we can afford it. Right, Ron?
That's the mayor, a chuckling, feathery kid in an oversized suit. He loves the idea and suggests paying Ron Scraper's consulting fee by redirecting funds from city public schools and affordable housing. Suddenly, music starts. Lines of dancing 3rd graders flood the stage. They're holding iPads made out of cardboard and glitter, and they sing about looking down on the less fortunate people from expensive homes they just bought in a formerly working-class neighborhood. I bought a sleek condo for about $5 million, right on top of Potrero Hill. At one point, the band slows down, and this angelically round-faced child steps into a spotlight for his solo. You can see his face, straining to find his note.
We need a ray of light to pierce that foggy sky.
This place is perfect for sunny weather.
Taking our city from behind our back.
It's a San Francisco dream.
So there they were, these blameless children, up there performing a kind of kiddie grotesque of the same exasperated conversation that all us parents were constantly having behind their backs. The conversation that more and more seemed to hang over every conversation in San Francisco, then inevitably spiraled into panicked Zillow searches for homes in Oakland or Petaluma or Portland. The after-school program that staged the play is a nonprofit called CASA, Children's After School Arts. It was staffed in part by young artsy people, many of whom only worked there part-time and seemed to be scraping by in the city, tossed around by the same turbulence. I'd gotten to know a few of them during the year. They were cool, kind-hearted people, and my daughter loved them. But now, it felt like they were indoctrinating my little girl. I was kind of angry at them, even if I was basically sympathetic to their cause. The cost of living in San Francisco had become the greatest source of anxiety for my family in the last couple of years. We constantly wrestled with whether it was worth trying to live here anymore. But my instinct had been to shield my kids from all that stress and instability, not conscript them. I mean, the only school play I could remember being in as a kid was called Care Bears Class Show. I played a green one. The play went on. There was a scene about Google buses, a song about FOMO, and a time travel sequence with the ghosts of San Francisco past, present, and future through the gold rush and the summer of love. My daughter's kindergarten class twirled with flowers in their hair, and there was an impressive cameo by a miniature Allen Ginsberg.
I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, dragging themselves through the streets at dawn. Angel-headed hipsters boning for the ancient heavenly connection to the starry dynamo and the machinery of night.
Here's the plot, though. Spoiler alert, I guess. Ron Scraper's real client turns out to be a shadowy tech corporation plotting to build something called The Dock. Ostensibly, The Dock is a big, cool cafe with what the kids on stage keep calling top-notch, organic, hand-picked, single-sourced, locally roasted, individually dripped coffee. But actually, it's a trap. In a later scene, the executives meet to discuss their real plot in private. When San Franciscans come to The Dock and plug in their laptops or phones, the company will install malware on their devices and steal their personal data.
Soon, this beautiful city will belong to Scraper Advertising and ICU Technologies.
See, that's the name of their privacy-breaching, data-scraping tech company, ICU Technologies. As the plot unspools, of course the company has to evict someone. And it's a close-knit group of multicultural tenants from an old Victorian at 1906 Babylon Lane. The tenants line up in front of their stoop, like a row of glum rockettes, and sing the eviction blues.
They're taking the floor from under our feet. Yes, they're taking the floor from right here under our feet. We want to keep fighting, but we're already beat.
It was here, during this number, that I suddenly realized why my daughter had turned to me out of nowhere on the way home from school a couple of weeks earlier and asked whether our landlords planned to evict us. It surprised me she even knew that word.
The broken heart, I gotta move. I don't know what I'm gonna do. Eviction.
The eviction song killed. Everything killed. Which was strange, given something I haven't mentioned till now. Maybe half the parents in the auditorium actually worked in tech, and now they were watching their own children spear them as cartoon villains, literally cackling and throwing money over flutes of champagne as they plotted the eviction of all those nice people. No one in the audience booed, of course, or huffed or stamped out. We were watching our kids perform. But I can't imagine what it must have been like to keep smiling along as you suddenly realize that for weeks after school, your own son or daughter had been rehearsing songs that mocked both you and the job you were off busy working, which is why you'd been forced to entrust your kids to the after-school program in the first place. I later heard that one father in the tech industry had gotten wind of the play's plot and actually written to the director, expressing concern. This led to a long, explanatory email to all us parents with the subject line, "Is the CASA musical anti-tech?" The short answer is no, the director wrote. The characters are fictional exaggerations, and no one group can be blamed for San Francisco's struggles. That said, she insisted, we do not attempt to answer questions with our art, but rather to ask questions. After the eviction blues, the curtain fell on Act One. Intermission. And we all filtered into the courtyard for paella and juice boxes. A neighbor of mine who works in tech walked over, and I noticed he felt compelled to lead with a good-humored joke about how he hoped I didn't mind chatting with the enemy. I took it as his way, subconsciously at least, to show he was brushing it off. There were no hard feelings. We weren't the caricatures we'd been watching on stage. The real truth was in this interaction, him and me. And he was right. His family was wonderful. We'd spent Halloween at their place, and one night, when I sliced my finger open cooking, I'd run over, and his wife, an ER doctor, cleaned me up and assured me I wouldn't need stitches while I bled all over their kitchen sink. All that familiarity colored our conversation at intermission. And yet, I'd be lying if I said that in that moment, I wasn't also conscious of something else. That my growing family couldn't afford to rent a bigger apartment in our neighborhood. That our days were numbered. And that he, meanwhile, had recently bid up their house across the street to 25% over asking. I hated that I was thinking about that, but I was. And I hated to think that he might be thinking about it too. But at the same time, and I'm definitely not proud of this, I also hated that maybe he wasn't thinking about it, that he had the luxury not to, that as we stood there laughing off the play together, his laughter might have been unencumbered, casual laughter, and not uncomfortable laughter. Not even slightly uncomfortable. I was embarrassed to recognize all those high-pitched voices in the play, stammering their shakily memorized platitudes. They were the voices in my head.
It's all the techies' fault. Everyone was just fine before they moved in. Hey, does anyone have a phone with power? I really need to get online.
The techies are not the enemies. We are also dependent on the technological advances they have brought.
Yeah. Some of my best friends are techies.
The real enemies are selfishness and greed.
What's wrong with selfishness and greed? We all have to look out for ourselves, right?
That was last May. We don't live in San Francisco anymore. We moved a couple of months later. We still loved living in the city, but life there had started to feel impossible for us in the long term, for reasons which were apparently close enough to what was unfolding on that stage that, at some point in Act Two, my wife started to cry. We were lucky to have options. We went somewhere small, semi-rural, and far away. A place where we could afford to buy a pretty cool house and work a little less, and where the children's theater program in town is satisfied doing Mary Poppins. Sometimes up here, I think about that class play, and I can measure how long we've been gone from the Bay Area by how impossible that performance, how impossible the very idea of an elementary school musical about eviction has started to feel. When I think about it now, I don't feel the same discomfort, like I'm watching all my own agonizing worries performed in song. What I mostly feel is pride. Pride that my kid got to be a part of it. And pride that she got to live in a place where people cared so deeply about what their city should be that even children's musical theater seemed like a way to hash that question out. And they loved their city so much that inevitably they felt compelled to give their musical a happy ending. Even if it meant lacing the last act with a series of preposterous plot twists. The mayor suddenly realizes he's been duped by scraper advertising and ICU technologies.
I had no idea. I would never approve such a horrible plan. The tenants of 1906 Babylon Lane will not be evicted from their home.
Even Ron Scraper comes around.
Oh, fine. Scraper Advertising and ICU Technologies will be working together to provide affordable housing to the people of San Francisco. Woo! San Francisco, where you can afford to live!
That's the lead-in to the play's big final number, a huge demonstration in front of San Francisco's City Hall, with the entire K-5 ensemble marching down the aisles and out of the wings. They're activists now, pouring on stage, holding signs, and singing about how they've had enough.
We gotta shake things up. We have had enough. We gotta scream and yell and shout everywhere and sing.
My daughter is barely 4 feet tall, a sometimes bashful little girl who has trouble pronouncing gentrifier correctly. And on stage, just then, she was absolutely dwarfed by an older, louder kid behind her who was waving a massive placard that read, "Resistance equals love of community." Still, I'm glad to have the memory of her up there on the fringes of the resistance, mouthing the words.